Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Quite a weekend, huh? Things really got going late Friday afternoon when President Obama came out and said this.
There will be costs for any military intervention in Ukraine.
So what do you suppose that actually means? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 3rd of March. Good as always to have you with us. My guess is that President Obama was speaking geopolitically when he made that "there will be costs" remark on Friday. Sanctions, isolation, trade repercussions, you know the list. And that may well come to pass, but let's us talk actual cold hard cash costs, all right, just as a way to frame things. A main Russian stock index dropped more than 10% today. The ruble hit a record low against the dollar and the euro before being bailed out by the Russian central bank to the tune of $10 billion. And speaking of the Russian central bank, by the way, it bumped its key interest rate a full percent and a half overnight, so money itself is more expensive in Russia. With all of that as a backdrop, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith gets us going.
It's been a dramatic few days for the Russian economy.
They've had a market meltdown.
Willis Sparks is a political risk analyst with Eurasia Group. Still, Sparks says Russia's probably not too worried for now. It has cash reserves of $490 billion.
That money, that rainy day fund, is designed specifically to help the Russian government absorb a shock.
There is talk of sanctions now, and Russia's economy is almost entirely dependent on oil and natural gas exports. But Europe gets more than a quarter of its natural gas from Russia, so oil analyst Stephen Schork doesn't think real sanctions would stick.
So I have zero confidence that any sort of meaningful sanction will be enacted.
But even relatively toothless sanctions would scare off foreign investors, says Lilit Gevorgyan, senior economist at IHS Global Insight.
The reputational damage is a concern for Moscow. It is critical to improve its investment image, to attract foreign capital.
But Eurasia Group's Willis Sparks thinks Russian President Vladimir Putin's willing to pay the price.
Putin is enjoying being unpredictable, and that's not good for markets, and frankly, he doesn't care, because the stakes for Russia and Ukraine are so high that they're willing to absorb some market volatility.
Still, says Sparks, Russia needs Western technology to extract its vast oil and natural gas resources. If relations with the West become too strained, Russia could find itself in very deep economic trouble. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There is obviously more to this whole thing than just the straight economics of it. Natalia Antalava is in Crimea. She is with the BBC there. Natalia, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Tell us, would you, first of all, what it's like day to day out on the streets? What's the public reaction to all of this that's going on?
Well, I think one way to describe it is that it's just extremely, extremely tense. There is a resemblance of normal life. There are people out in the streets, but all government buildings here have been taken over by the Russian soldiers. Crimea is a place with a gentle ethnic balance. It's mostly Russian. 60% of the population are Russian. But the indigenous population of Crimea are Crimean Tatars. They're Muslim. And they're also Ukrainians, of course. And all these groups are really worried. And all of them are saying that the presence of Russian troops have inflamed tensions that have existed here, but have been dormant for a really long time.
Are people doing what people do when things get tense and there's a lot of uncertainty? Are they stocking up? Have they stripped the stores of all the produce and all the canned goods and all that?
Well, the prices are going up. The fuel prices are going up. So I have spoken to quite a few people in the streets who are not working, who are worried about jobs. Lots of shops are closed. Some restaurants are closed. Not all of them, though. There are definitely economic fears. I was just talking to a Russian businessman here in Crimea who manufactures various goods and sells for export to Western Europe. And he's saying that his factory has basically stopped working. And he says a lot of businesses are no longer working. And he was saying this is going to be catastrophic because Crimea is a peninsula and it has been virtually sealed off.
Are people leaving? I mean, along those lines, are the highways crowded? Are the ports crowded?
Well, the ports have been taken over by the military ships. There is a very tense standoff in the port of Sevastopol right now between the Russian and Ukrainian military ships. I can't say that there is any sort of sign of mass exodus anywhere, but there is definitely a lot of nervousness. And I keep meeting men who are saying we're going to send our women and children away, but they're also saying that they will have to stay here in case they need to fight.
The basics, like fuel for cars, those kinds of things. Are there lines at gas stations?
No, there aren't any visible lines to gas stations. I mean, remember, this is only a few days old. The economic situation is expected to be worse. I think the biggest concern for people right now isn't even so much the economy. It's violence. I think this is a region on the edge. And everyone here, you can really feel this nervous tension. And the real fear is, as it has always happened in all post-Soviet conflicts, once the regular Russian army moves in, the irregulars come in. They are the Cossacks, people from the Caucasus, and they're the ones who stir up the trouble. And people are saying that they're already here.
Natalia Antalava with the BBC. We got her in Simferopol, the provincial capital of Crimea. Natalia, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
On Wall Street today, your standard geopolitical tensions trading pattern, GTTP, for short. Stocks down, oil up, gold up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Environmental Protection Agency announced new emissions standards for gasoline today. The goal is to reduce the amount of sulfur that gets released into the air, something the Obama administration has been pushing for since 2010, which in turn brings us to this cost-benefit calculation, the billions of dollars that refiners say they will have to spend to get up to code versus the health benefits that supporters figure will save us far more money eventually. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Under the new EPA regulations, the amount of sulfur in gasoline will be reduced by two-thirds. Refineries and automakers have to comply by 2017.
We'll get an immediate public health benefit in 2017 when the cleaner fuel comes onto the market.
Janet McCabe is with the EPA, which predicts that by 2030, there will be significant health benefits from the reduction in sulfur emissions and smog.
The standards will prevent up to 2,000 premature deaths each year, 2,200 hospital admissions and emergency room visits, 50,000 respiratory incidences for children,
and nearly 1.5 million fewer lost school and work days. Based on EPA estimates, the price of gas will increase by less than a penny per gallon, and the price of a new car will go up by $75. Oil refineries say the cost increase will be 10 times that. Charles T. Drevna is president of the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. It opposes the new regulations. Drevna says they will cost the industry $10 billion.
And absolutely, in our opinion, a little or no environmental benefit.
The argument over the regulation is a question of how to balance short-term costs against long-term benefits, an issue that is not without precedent, says Joel Kaufman, a professor of environmental health at the University of Washington.
The refineries went through a similar exercise in the last 10 years.
Kaufman says there's evidence to suggest that reducing sulfur emissions will lead to health benefits in the future.
And that the expense is going to be modest, maybe more expensive than EPA is estimating, but certainly more likely less expensive than industry is estimating.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
The next frontier for Apple and Google and Microsoft? It's your car. Tech companies want to know where you go for lunch, what your favorite song or, you know, public radio program is to play on the way home, also how fast you drive. So to that end, this week, Apple will launch something called CarPlay. It is, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein tells us, the latest assault in the fight over our dashboards.
Raise your hand if you've texted, searched for music, or responded to emails. You know, crazy stuff while you're driving. Well, those days may be coming to an end.
Today is simply about music and navigation from your smartphone being projected onto the screen in the car.
Forrester analyst Frank Gillette says Apple's new product, CarPlay, is basically an extension of the iPhone. Apple says beginning this year, through the dashboard, drivers can use touchscreens or voice commands to operate their phones in some car models, including Hondas and Volvos. Gillette says Apple has abandoned the idea of using a built-in system that can work independent of the phone.
there's so much less to figure out. You know how to use your iPhone, therefore you know how to use the iPhone in the car, as opposed to having to learn an entirely new system.
Well, this is happening because big ecosystem giants like Apple and Google are all recognizing that you can't ignore the consumer as soon as he or she steps into the vehicle.
Gartner automotive analyst Tilo Koslowski says the tech firms are looking for every opportunity to become part of our lives, and there seems to be a market. According to consulting firm Accenture, 39% of car buyers say these types of devices are a top selling point. Koslowski says Apple is attempting to anticipate our needs, bringing more convenience and value, but it could get out of hand.
This is where the creepiness line comes into play, that eventually consumers might not find it all that useful if these companies know too much about you. And those boundaries still have to be defined.
Even with that cautionary note, Koslowski expects this to quickly become a multi-billion dollar market. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Housing prices are mostly back from the worst of the crash. Not doing so well, though. One particular category of things that people often like to put in their homes, antiques. Prices for wooden furniture made a couple of 300 years ago are way, way down, which means if you've always wanted to fill your house with a giant dark mahogany Victorian, now's your moment. If you're hoping to sell, well, you should pay attention to Dan Bobkoff.
Opening bid, $500.
One Saturday a month, the Capo Auction in Queens invites the public to bid on everything from art to pianos to antique furniture. Some stuff does quite well. Other times, the auctioneer has to beg a little.
Any interest at $400? Pretty please? $400?
The stuff here comes from all different eras. But if you want to see what's happened to traditional antiques, old wood furniture and the like, see what happens when the auctioneer gets to lot 527.
Lot 527 is the Regency mahogany drum table.
Let's just say it's a bargain.
Very undesirable now. No one, it's bringing much less than it did 10 years ago.
Karen Cangelosi is Capo's chief appraiser. She says that mahogany drum table,
I believe it's in with an estimate of $1,000 to $1,500, and it's a piece that we probably 10 years ago would have had an estimate of $5,000 to $7,000.
So, okay, back on the auction floor now.
We'll open the bids at $1,100.
And the mahogany table goes for?
Sold, $1,300.
A steal. Experts say prices for stuff from the late 1700s and 1800s is down as much as 60 to 80%.
You can find period American antique furniture for prices that are not any more than new quality furniture costs.
Lincoln Sanders is the executive director of the Antique Dealers Association of America. And like many things in this economy, Sanders says the best quality pieces have held up. It's the mid-level that's tanked.
Eights, nines, and tens are doing pretty well, but the stuff that's fives and sixes are not, and prices are down considerably.
Kenneth Ames and his wife recently downsized their home and sold many of their antiques.
And the result was, which we knew would happen, pretty substantial loss.
He says for most pieces, he got about 30 cents on the dollar. Some did even worse. A Federal-style desk and bookcase from around 1820.
So it was a cute little thing.
He bought it in the 90s for about $1,200. Today,
after the auction houses commission, I think we got somewhere between $200 and $300 for that.
Why are things so depressed? Experts say younger buyers just aren't as interested in taking the time to find good pieces. And their style, brownwood furniture from the 18th and 19th centuries, just isn't in right now. Many people covet the sleek, simple lines of mid-century modern. And cheap versions are easy to find at stores like IKEA and West Elm. Ames is also a professor at the Bard Graduate Center. He knows a lot about antiques, and he thinks the business got itself into a bubble. Part-time dealers were also often the buyers of antiques.
Buying frequently from one another, back and forth, one dealer to another. So some of the illusion of retail health was a little bit fraudulent.
It's like hot potato, he says. It drove up prices, and the combination of the financial crisis and changes in fashion proved devastating to the antique market. Ames thinks we were lulled into the idea that antiques would never fall in price. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Coming up, the things you learn on this program.
There's a global strategic reserve of maple syrup, and they call it the surplus.
So how about that, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Ooh, the wah-wah trombones. Been a while. The Dow Industrials dropped 153 points, 0.9%. Wrapped at 16,168. I wonder how you say wah-wah trombones in Russian. Anyway, the NASDAQ unplugged 30 points, 0.75%. Finished at 4,277. The S&P 500 lost 13 points, also 0.75%. Ended at 1,845. Darden Restaurants, the parent company of Olive Garden and Red Lobster, scraped off 5.75% today. Darden projects poor winter sales because of, yes, the harsh weather. Lorillard, maker of Newport cigarettes, rose 9%. Today on news that R.J. Reynolds is considering a takeover bid. Reynolds puffed up nearly 5%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.6%. That's called a flight to quality, a flight to safety. Everybody, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, a hearing in the House focuses on the role of technology in protecting Americans from international cyber criminals. People magazine turns the big 4-0. The first issue was published on March 4, 1974. Mia Farrow graced the cover. And tomorrow is National Grammar Day. You can do your part by speaking and writing well and placing your commas correctly. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We, that is Marketplace, are 25 years old this year, a full quarter century of figuring out business and the economy. So we're doing something special to mark the milestone, a series called 25 for 25.
25 years.
25 things.
Jobs. Revenue.
The economy.
The American people.
Today, the humble dollar bill. You've looked at it a million times, probably, without really seeing it. All that symbology on the back, that pyramid with the creepy-looking all-seeing eye, what's that all about? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
First thing to remember, there are a lot of conspiracy theories about the dollar's eye and pyramid. I wanted to see which ones were most popular, so I headed across town to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to do my own informal street survey. First up, Ginny Cochran, who actually works at the Mint. Her theory?
Something to do with the Masons, and I know it goes farther back than that.
Well, it does go way back, to the founding of our country. Some of the founding fathers were Masons, and the eye has become a Masonic symbol. But it was actually added by an engraver who wasn't a Mason, according to Stephen Bullock. He teaches history at the Worcester Polytechnic Institute.
The official term is that's the eye of Providence. That's the eye of God, or in some general way.
Okay, but where did the pyramid come from? Next theory from my impromptu survey?
Maybe King Tut, that might be his pyramid.
That's 9-year-old Brian Bush, who just finished touring the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. He says they didn't mention the dollar bill's pyramid on the tour. The conspiracy theorists would say, they don't want us to know. But actually, Brian's on to something.
The pyramid was seen as the kind of human structure that lasted out the ages.
That's Bill Ellis, a professor emeritus of American Studies at Penn State. He says the founding fathers wanted the country to last as long as the pyramids. But the pyramid and eye didn't show up on the dollar bill until 1935. They started out as part of our Great Seal. FDR added them to the dollar. That brings us to our next conspiracy theory, courtesy of Andrew Epting, who was waiting for a bus near the Mint.
New World Order is very folklorish.
New Order. It does say that in Latin, under the pyramid. Historians say that refers to the birth of a new country. And FDR liked the way it jived with his New Deal. But for conspiracy theorists, the words New Order on the dollar bill were a signal that the U.S. government had been taken over by evil forces. Epting says that's crazy.
You know, I'm glad we have video games now and TV to take people's minds off some of this stuff nowadays.
Of course, some video games actually revolve around conspiracy theories, and Hollywood doesn't help with movies like National Treasure.
The unfinished pyramid, the all-seeing eye, are telling us something.
So is it any wonder there are so many conspiracy theories about such a strange symbol, especially since we carry it around in our pockets? In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We're taking your suggestions for our series 25 for 25. Tell us what you want to know about the economy. 25 years worth. Letters at marketplace.org. Assuming the weather cooperates, and yes, I know that is far from a sure thing this winter, but assuming it does, we are not far from what's called in certain parts of the Northeast sugar season, that magical week or two when temperatures are just right, a little bit below freezing at night, a little above freezing during the day when the sap runs and we eventually get maple syrup. Sugar season is also the name of a new book about the maple syrup industry by Doug Wynot. He followed Bruce Bascom around for a while to write it. Bruce is the owner of Bascom Maple Farms up in Alstead, New Hampshire. They are both on the line today. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Yep, good to be here also.
Doug, let me start with you and ask you why you wrote a book about maple syrup.
Sure. Some of my previous research for another book took me to the Bascom Maple Farm, where I learned that Bruce was the biggest maple syrup producer in New Hampshire. They now make 1/4 of all the syrup produced in New Hampshire. I went to Bascom Maple Farms and talked to Bruce, and he talked about the industry at length. And then I asked if I could go out into the woods with his workers and watch them tap trees. By then, I'd begun to think that this was a very interesting business and industry, and I decided to stay and to observe and talk for as long as I could. That ended up being 3 years.
Bruce, set the scene for me. When the sap is running and you've got people out in the woods putting all these spouts in trees, what does it look like? What does it sound like?
A typical maple tree usually only flows about, if he had a sap bucket, he would do about 10 gallons of sap. So a single spout tree, you might make only 1/4 maple syrup, because usually it's about 40 gallons of sap to 1 gallon of maple syrup.
Wow.
Under the newer technology nowadays with vacuum tubing, a lot of times people are getting twice as much sap.
When so you say vacuum tubing, are you guys actually sucking the sap out of the tree? Is it negative pressure and all that?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, we have 5/16 plastic tubing that runs into a larger pipe, like 3/4 inch, 1 inch, and so forth, and eventually down the bottom of a mountain into a single large tanks. So we might have 5,000 trees that go to one spot that a truck comes and pumps over the sap and then drives back to the sugar house for the boiling process.
So if you got five, I don't even know how many trees you have under production, but how many miles of pipe is that you're dealing with?
That's a good question. We have about... We have about 80,000 taps, so that's going to be 20 feet per tap. So I guess that's about 300 miles of pipe.
Wow. That's
roughly.
Crazy.
It's a lot of walking in snowshoes.
It's a lot of walking in snowshoes, I bet. Doug, there are, in fact, even geopolitics in the maple syrup thing. I mean, the Canadians and the Quebecois and black markets and everything.
Yeah, there are geopolitics involved. Quebec produces about 70 to 80% of the world supply of maple syrup. And they have an organization called the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers, consisting of about 7,200 producers. And the federation effectively controls the world price of syrup. And, of course, there's going to be a black market which attempts to circumvent the rules of the federation. But the federation stabilized the world's price of syrup and sets the world price of syrup.
You go back 20 years ago, the price would rise by 50 to 100% over 3 years, and it'd get too high and wouldn't sell well, and then it would drop by 40, 50% and get too low, and everybody would run short, and it would seesaw up and down. It's been relatively stable in Canadian dollars for about 7 or 8 years. The only thing difference, of course, is the currency fluctuations.
I will say this not to be pejorative at all, but have you heard of OPEC and oil? It sort of sounds a little similar. I don't know.
It is a little similar. There's a global strategic reserve of maple syrup.
No, there's not. Is there really?
Yes, there is. And they call it the surplus. The maple syrup production depends on weather. And if there are some uncooperative winters, the surplus is there for producers to rely on to fill their orders.
Sounds like there's 1,000 ways to lose your shirt in this business, Bruce.
Well, the weather sometimes is a problem, but right now the market is expanding and consumption is growing by about 10% per year, and production is also growing by about 10% per year.
I'll tell you what, though, when I go to the store and I look for the good, the actual maple syrup stuff as opposed to the, you know, sugar water stuff or whatever it is, you know, you get the good grade A stuff and it is not cheap on store shelves.
Well, of course, everybody thinks they make the very best and want the highest price.
Of course. Bruce Bascom runs Bascom Maple Farms. Douglas Wynot wrote a book about it. It's called The Sugar Season. Gentlemen, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I will confess right up front, I am totally ripping off from Ben Johnson and Marketplace Tech. They're going down to South by Southwest in Austin, Texas next week. They'll do the show there, maybe a couple of panels, too. About which panels, by the way? This. Do you ever notice how buzzy panel names are? How hard they're trying to lure you in with catchy titles, with real titles like this? Teeny Tiny Video, Great Big Impact, or Big Data Inverted, The Best Candy from Strangers. I don't even know what that means. But anyway, we've got a patented Marketplace South by Southwest panel name generator on our website. Give it a spin, see what you come up with. I tried it before I came into the studio today, and I got, quote, how to be the Kai Rizdahl of LARPing, unquote, which would be great if only I knew what LARPing was. Somebody, I'm sure, will tell me. You can check it out at marketplace.org. And with that, we are done. That is Marketplace from APM. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I am the king of LARPing, Kai Rizdahl. Somebody, please tell me. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.